welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, January 8th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher Gunathchish. Hawa, Tuaksuk Newsom, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, we get transported through the living science of Southeast Alaska's coastal rainforest with a new podcast, The Seabank Chronicles, a series of 7-minute transmissions about science and mystery in Southeast Alaska. We chat with Bob Armstrong and Brenda Wright from Juno Audubon ahead of Bob's talk, Ravens in Juno, happening this Thursday, January 9th. And we talk with the USDA Forest Service about the Tongass Forest Plan revision assessment and the upcoming series of fireside chats back for another year at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Those conversations plus Tongass Voices coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kehinak John Martin. And the word this week is Yanshuka.
Yanshuka.
That means camp. And here is a sentence.
Asteh. Asteh awa Yanshuka de Huyanakwej.
People fish when they travel by boat to camp. Let's hear it again.
Yanshuka.
Camp. Gunathchish to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska at Southeast for this audio.
Kehinuk John Martin was Dakdane Tan and a child of a Kagwantan man. He is from the Hunakawu, the people of Huna, and was a contributing elder and speaker at many language immersion gatherings in Glacier Bay, Yakutat, and Juneau. He attended boarding school in Shkakwe, Skagway, and attended Gonzaga University.
Tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Seabank Initiative is an Alaskan Sustainable Fisheries Trust program that identifies, assesses, and communicates the value of the Southeast Alaska ecosystem. And they have a new podcast, The Seabank Chronicles, which is a science and mystery podcast that takes listeners on a 7-minute sound-rich journey through various topics of the Southeast ecosystem. I'm joined now by the series writer, producer, and host, Beth Short Rhodes, who KTOO listeners might recognize from another series we play here on Juno Afternoon, A Savory Moment. Gunathchish, Ha'iyudi, thank you so much, Beth, for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. Wasa'iyati, how's it going?
It's going great. Gunathchish, for having me here on Juno Afternoon. I'm so excited to join you and your listeners to talk about the Seabank Chronicles.
Yeah, we love A Savory Moment. We usually play it about weekly, right? Usually on the Wednesday program. Today, we won't be playing it because we're going to hear your voice in a different podcast, The Seabank Chronicles. But before we talk about that, can you share a little bit about your background and how you got into producing and hosting audio podcasts?
Absolutely. Well, I am a diehard public radio fan. I have been listening to public radio ever since my high school years in Anchorage, where I discovered public radio and a whole new world opened up to me there. It was ideas and new perspectives that I hadn't encountered before as a young person in the big city of Anchorage. So I think I absorbed a lot of kind of the sensibility of those short interstitials and little snippets of information, and always, you know, sort of dreamed of doing my own. And then the opportunity came up. I actually got a biology degree from Western Washington University, and that sort of in a very roundabout way led me to the Seabank Chronicles podcast with my work as a seafood chef kind of thrown in the mix there.
I see. Yeah, because I know in Sitka, do you still do the fireweed dinner service?
I do, yes. I still do that. And then the savory moment kind of came out of that. And what I realized over the years, I did some commercial fishing as well. I realized that everything that was supporting my life, whether it was my business, you know, the food that I was putting on the table, the walks and runs that I take through the forest, really all come back to this generous ecosystem that supports everyone that lives in Southeast Alaska. So I joined up with friends at the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust, and we had the idea of doing this ecosystem podcast.
Yeah, I love that. And I should say you're based in Sitka, which is where, I mean, people in Juneau are like, I want fireweed dinner service. Well, you'd have to go to Sitka to get that.
Yes. Yes, you would.
Okay. So let's talk about Seabank Chronicles. Tell us a little bit about what the Seabank Initiative is. I know I mentioned it's a program of the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust, but then they have the Seabank Initiative, which is like one of their programs, right?
Yes, that is correct. And it revolves around the idea of a sea bank, a bank that actually resides and is the ecosystem of the forest and ocean here in Southeast Alaska. So this natural bank provides these incredible dividends that sometimes we take for granted. It provides jobs. It provides a food supply, indigenous culture, recreation, and all of the good health that comes with, you know, being outside, the mental, physical, and spiritual health. So this bank that we are so privileged to, you know, be embedded in, really, we're part of it. It provides us that everything, with everything that we need to have a good life. And so the Seabank Initiative is getting that message out and just introducing that concept that we really do live in this bank, and that if we steward its resources wisely, we can continue to receive these dividends.
Yeah, and they have other resources available on the website, I would imagine, too, in terms of different programs that they have and different explanations of what this is for. I know it's to empower people to have knowledge, right? To not just visitors,
yes,
but also people who live here, policymakers. It's all of those folks who need to have that information to kind of understand that ecosystem and how they're, what the programs are and what we need to know about it to move forward, which I think is great. And I'm imagining that that's one reason that they then decided to do a podcast. Is this to get the word out, to get to unravel some of these mysteries? Why did they want to do a podcast?
Well, really, it's the podcast is to support the crown jewel of the Seabank Initiative, which is the Seabank Report. Every year, we produce a giant report. It's 266 pages that that describes the value of these ecosystems, and it describes the fiscal and economic value, which makes it really unique. It's sort of a combination between an atlas where you can go in and read about the different parts of the ecosystem, but also uses economic data, public economic data, and gives you a sense of what are these ecosystems worth really economically. If you want to look at it that way, I have some statistics here. Our ecosystem provides $1 billion in economic dividends from the fishing industry and tourism. It provides 16,500 jobs and 2.7 billion metric tons of climate mitigating carbon sequestration. So this, the Seabank report quantifies the value of the ecosystem. And it's just another way of understanding why we should protect this place. And so policymakers and citizens can actually go online and read this report, and it provides a lot of unique information that they can use to make a case for preserving our ecosystem, because a strong economy is something that all Southeast Alaskans can agree on. And if we keep our ecosystem healthy, we're going to keep our economy healthy.
And then for the podcast, I'm wondering like what your goal is with the podcast, because I know it's really sound rich. There's a lot of sounds in there that we recognize. You're sort of unraveling some of the things, and you're asking questions in the podcast, and you're trying to answer those for people? Or what's your goal for the podcast?
Well, the goal is to provide yet another avenue for people to understand the ecosystem of Southeast Alaska. And whereas the report is very data-driven, it's dense, it's everything you need to make a case for ecosystem preservation. The podcast is really meant to kind of reach people on a more emotional level. Every time you listen to an episode, you are actually stepping into the ecosystem. You are a citizen scientist on the ground, receiving transmissions from a radio operator and instructions for traveling through the ecosystem and learning. So the point of the podcast is to really provide another view on our ecosystem, to teach people some of the basic science, and just to provide a really fun time and just kind of a break from whatever's going on. You can immerse yourself in sounds and music and just really be transported into the mysteries of the Southeast Alaska ecosystem.
I love that. It's sort of breaking it down in a more accessible way. So why is the podcast 7 minutes? I'm curious if there's some science behind that.
You know, I wanted something that would be fairly short, but I wanted it to be long enough that people could really actually learn something. And 7 to me just seemed like kind of a mysterious number. 7 times 7 is 49. We're the 49th state. It just seemed like kind of a good fit.
And how many episodes, or how often will episodes be released? Are there going to be seasons of episodes?
There will be seasons. We plan to release a new season every fall when we release the new CBANC report. So they kind of go together. You have the big data-heavy report, and then you have this lighter and kind of more mysterious element that is the Chronicle. So each year we will produce a new season in the fall.
Okay, I see. That's great. So, and how did you come up with that fun naming convention of the Logbook 1, Transmission 1, Logbook 1, Transmission 2? How did you come up with that sort of conceit for the podcast?
You know, I started writing the scripts, and I wanted something that was going to be a little bit different. And I guess I sort of thought of Star Trek, you know, I forget what exactly they say at the beginning of Star Trek, but I wanted to have it to have kind of a journal-like feel, sort of like a science report type of feel. And so I just played around, and eventually the idea of a logbook and transmissions just popped in during the creative process.
I love that. That's so good. Well, we're going to hear an episode. We're going to hear Logbook 1, Transmission 1, the very first episode, Do You Hear a Climate Stronghold? Can you set this episode up for us a little bit?
Sure. This is the introductory episode to the CBANC Chronicles. And this is when you are first transported into the Southeast Alaska ecosystem. You step inside, you have the radio operator in your ear. You're going to map the boundaries of this place and go through and meet some of the star players in the ecosystem, and then learn why scientists have pegged this as a climate refuge and why its immense integrity and wholeness makes it really gives it a future as a place where species are going to survive in the coming decades and centuries.
I love that. Well, Beth Short-Rhodes, thank you so much, Gunathchish, for sharing a little bit about this. We look forward to sharing these episodes over the coming weeks on Juno Afternoon, as well as continuing your other series, A Savory Moment. For more on the podcast, you can go to thealaskatrust.org/CBANC Chronicles podcast, or you can just add the podcast through your favorite podcast app, which is awesome. And for more on Beth, you can visit fireweeddinners.com, and that will also have a link on there to The Savory Moment. If you can't wait for episodes, I know you have a new season of that, and there's more seasons of A Savory Moment coming, I'm imagining, too, Beth, right?
Yep, Absolutely. I'm going to continue on with that.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much. So here we go. We're going to listen to Logbook 1, Transmission 1, Do You Hear a Climate Stronghold of the Seabank Chronicles. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Gunath Chish Besh, thank you so much.
Gunath Chish, thank you.
You've reached the Seabank Chronicles, a natural sound theater transporting you through the living science of Southeast Alaska. Produced by the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust. This is Beth, your radio operator. We live in extraordinary times, where science and mystery meet in a swiftly changing world. To enter the Seabank Chronicles, just keep listening. Logbook 1, Transmission 1, Refuge. If you're listening, you've made it to the Seabank, a rain-drenched nook of North Pacific ocean and earth where ecological riches find refuge, a bank in and of the sea. Human lives are built on this bank's dividends, livelihoods in fishing and tourism, products from forest and sea, recreation, art, and the good health that time in nature brings. You've made it to Southeast Alaska, ancestral lands of the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people. But where are you exactly? Open your pack and pull out a contour map. Find the west coast of North America, then zero in on the Gulf of Alaska. Draw a pencil mark at 54 degrees latitude at Dixon Entrance, and another at 60 degrees near Yakutat. These are your boundaries, north and south. Next, place a finger just off the continental shelf, that faint band of earthly crust descending into the tides. Here is the westernmost edge of the Seabank, an underwater domain where secret currents bubble, mixing nutrient-rich debris from the deep with terrestrial minerals to nourish microscopic plant life drifting across the ocean. Can you get a read on what those tiny plants are doing? They're harvesting sunlight, spinning carbon dioxide and water into sugar, a feast of nutritious carbohydrates to support all life in the sea. Take a look around. Halibut, black cod, and salmon are gathering to feed and grow. Fishing boats are pulling their own living from the sea. Now to the east. Slide a finger inland to a high-rise realm of ice and snow, held aloft by the Coast Range and St. Elias Mountains. Do you see the glaciers flowing? Breathtaking blue views live here, yes, but also reservoirs of fresh, clean water for rivers and streams, a safeguard against drought, a breath of icy wind to temper the planet's rising heat. Between highest mountain and deepest sea lies a forest. This forest is refreshingly cool in summer, mild in winter. It's lashed by wind and rain and splashed with sunlight. This isn't a tropical rainforest like those near the equator, but a coastal temperate rainforest, an ecological rarity arising closer to the poles and only when a special set of conditions align. The Seabank Forest is among the rarest because it feeds and is fed by salmon, a wild and silvery nation endlessly bound for home. Where rivers and ocean meet, find estuaries, way stations for nascent aquatic life. Draw a circle to contain it all and step inside the Seabank. Not a brick-and-mortar institution with tellers and a drive-up window, but one built of water and trees. A portfolio of ancient ecological riches that sustain and protect human life. The Seabank has a storied past as cradle for human lives and livelihoods going back at least 10,000 years. And now it's on the brink of an important future. Scientists see these lands and waters as an impending climate refuge. Let's dive in and find out why. The seabank has a high level of what scientists call ecosystem integrity, the self-sustaining ability to persist and thrive. Its forests are so old, so large, and so intact, bigger by far than any other national forest in the United States. They stand resilient, providing safe harbor for an untamed web of plant and animal species, with over 70,000 human lives stitched into its fabric. As the global climate continues to change, the seabank will increasingly become a stronghold. Data shows that while northern latitudes are warming rapidly, the pace in southeast Alaska is slower than nearby regions, thanks to the moderating influence of ocean waters. Species that struggle to carry on in hotter, drier places might find a place to endure here in what science calls a refugium. Does this mean the seabank doesn't need protection? No. Many species, including salmon, are still threatened by accelerating environmental shifts. It's more imperative than ever to keep Southeast Alaska wild and resilient for local salmon populations and others who might find sanctuary here in the future. It looks like we're losing signal. No doubt you have unanswered questions. What conditions align for this rainforest to form? What indigenous words describe this place? How can you protect this climate refuge? Stay tuned for future transmissions of the Seabank Chronicles. Until then, visit the alaskatrust.org/podcast for a map of the seabank and data on its extraordinary potential. Gunish Chish to the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people for stewarding these lands and waters since a time beyond human memory, and for sharing them with all who make the seabank home. When in doubt, keep listening to the places where science and mystery meet.
That was the Seabank Chronicles, a new 7-minute podcast exploring the mysteries and science of Southeast Alaska. You can find that in your favorite podcast app or listen here weekly on Juno Afternoon. Up next, we'll talk with the Juno Audubon Society and Bob Armstrong and preview his talk, Ravens in Juno. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. Juno Audubon Society presents its monthly program tomorrow, January 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, Ravens in Juno by Bob Armstrong. It's free and open to the public. And I'm joined now in studio by Brenda Wright from Juno Audubon and naturalist, photographer, and author Bob Armstrong, the featured presenter. Gunith Chish, welcome to the studio, both of you. Wasa iti, how's it going?
Great, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good. Nice to see you again, Brenda. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Awesome.
I try to get out every day, despite the weather.
I know, this weather's kind of nuts, isn't it? It's so good. Bob, I want to start with you. You are a renowned and well-known photographer, as well as a naturalist, and you've written some books, and it's just you've been around a while documenting all this stuff. I wanted to find out, how did this work find you all those years ago? When did it start?
You mean the work on ravens? Or?
No, just your work,
Oh.
As a photographer and naturalist. When did that come to you?
Well, it was weird. I was going to the University of Washington back in 1958 or something, and I saw a notice on the bulletin board, jobs available in Alaska, $200 a month or something. It wasn't very much, but back then it was good. And I thought, gosh, that sounds good. I'll apply to it. And I got immediately accepted, and all my colleagues there at the university said, oh, we don't want to go to Alaska. We don't want to live in an igloo.
Right, the misconceptions, right, of
right.
Alaska. Yeah, for sure. And so you found your way up here.
Yeah, I took a 4.5 hour plane trip and a normal airplane back then, and got off the plane in Juneau and was greeted by my supervisor, and he handed me a book to go out and purchase a truck and a 21-foot boat with two Johnsons on it, and to go out and see what the king salmon were doing. I thought I was in heaven.
Wow, wow. And you've never left.
And I've never left, right?
That's amazing. So I'm curious, what fascinates you the most about all the wildlife that you document?
I think what I enjoy the most is I sit quite a bit watching things, and I film them and so on, and then I'll see things that I don't understand. Something's going on go into the literature and the scientific literature and such, and sometimes it takes quite a while to figure out what it is. And also what I'm finding is some things that I see and learn, people that actually study that don't know what it is either.
Oh, wow. So, like, truly the mysteries, right, of
science.
Yeah,
and so that really excites me. And ravens has shown me some things that are unknown to science. So
I bet. We're going to get to those ravens in a second, but I got one question for you, one more question. In terms of the history, right, and what kinds of changes to the environment and wildlife have you seen over your years doing this work? I mean, you've been doing it since, like you said, 1958, 1960, right, somewhere around there?
Yeah, it's really sad for me. There's been huge declines worldwide in birds and insects and certain mammals and so on. And I've seen tremendous declines in the Juneau area. And when I first arrived here, I could row a boat out in Gastineau Channel, and I was guaranteed 3 halibut and 1 king salmon in an hour.
Mm. And now you're lucky if you get one, right?
Well, normally don't even get one.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I'm imagining just through your eyes, especially documenting it through photography and also just your work as a naturalist, like just to see that decline over the years. And what is your hope for the future, I guess, in terms of what can we do?
Boy, that's... You could spend several hours talking about that, but my major hope is to somehow get climate change eliminated.
Yeah.
And getting information out to young people seems to be the best. When it comes to money and politics and so on, it's hard to believe that anything will ever be done, but there's an incredible movie that just was produced not too long ago called Eating Ourselves to Extinction.
Mm, I haven't seen that.
And it's well worth looking at. It's very well done, and it's all scientifically based and so on. But it talks about the dangers worldwide, what are going on, and mostly in farming and such, and what's happening to the environment. But it's an excellent movie to look at.
I'll take a look at that. Thank you for the recommendation. Okay, so ravens. Ravens in Juneau and this talk tomorrow. What can we expect? What are you going to be talking about?
It'll be mostly videos that I've taken over the years and stories about what ravens are showing me or how they're reacting and so on. And they're one of the most fascinating creatures I've ever looked at. And when you think about it, they're the most widespread distributed bird in the world.
Mm.
And there are, I looked it up, and there are more than 1,400 scientific articles about them.
Wow. That's a lot.
Probably the most studied bird too.
What do you find fascinating about them?
That they often will seemed to relate to me and attempt to show me something.
Mm.
One time I was out at the Eagle Beach area where sandlance, you know, those about 4-inch fish that bury themselves in the sand.
Mm.
And I had to collect some to be sent off for PSP and paralytic shellfish poisoning analysis. And I had a 3-prong rake with me, and I couldn't find any. And this raven came down and landed about 3 feet from me and cocked his head and looked up at me. And then he walked over about 10 feet and dug up some sandlance. So I went over and I got about 3 or 4. I needed about 9. And then he again cocked his head and looked at me and walked in another direction and did the same thing.
Wow.
It's almost unbelievable that what they think and can do sometimes. And
the sense that he had for you, or that he knew what you were looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, and so are you still documenting them? Do you still take tons of photos? And obviously you're taking videos as well. You have a YouTube channel, right?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. What is that called, your YouTube channel?
Nature Bob.
Nature Bob?
Oh.
Well, that's got part of it.
Oh, well, the YouTube channel, I think, is just Bob Armstrong's YouTube channel. But okay. I also have a website that's called Nature Bob.
Oh, I see. Okay. There's probably links on there to all your different things,
yeah,
pictures and photos and videos.
Yeah, and they're all available for free.
That's
wonderful.
I
don't sell anything on my website.
Wow. Not monetizing yourself in any way.
Nope.
I love that. So that's going to be tomorrow night. This talk is happening at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall. It's at 6:30 p.m. It's Ravens in Juneau. What is the – I know they have like – I know we had our story last year about the white raven up in Anchorage. Do we have any special kind of – we have white ravens down here in Juneau at all? Have you ever seen a white raven?
We actually have a female raven out at the glacier that has white tail feathers.
Oh, okay.
And very easy to recognize.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And it's also a character and fun to go to the glacier and watch what it's doing. And it's,
yeah.
Apparently it's been there for a few years.
Okay. That's amazing. I love that.
They're totally in charge of the tourists, you know, those ravens.
Right.
They herd them in the correct direction to give them the best
view. Well, they're as smart as Bob says, right? I mean, that's what's going on there. I mean, they are very intelligent. They know exactly what's going on. And I mostly encounter them, you know, in my travels throughout town at Foodland and things like that. Yeah. And they're always looking for a little something. And I know they love French fries, you know, but probably we shouldn't be feeding them. Right, Bob?
I think they really love downtown.
Yeah.
And during the tourist season, the tourists get real excited when they see one. And they were walking along, and if they're munching on something, they'll give the raven a taste. And I think that's part of why they're so common in Juneau.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, they know where the good food is. They know where the suckers are.
Yep.
Who are going to give them the food. So, Brenda, what's on tap for Juneau Audubon? I know you have this talk tomorrow, and then you have a membership meeting this month as well, right?
Well, this is the membership meeting, and we have a board meeting on the 27th. But next month in February, we're having a NOAA expert on ecosystem reports, and he's going to focus on seabirds. That would be Ebert Calvert-Sidden.
Oh, nice. That one. Okay, that's coming up. And then when did the spring walks begin? April?
Actually, mid-April. Uh-huh.
That's mid-April.
When the biggest starts of the migration are mid-April.
Okay.
I guess it's not because we don't have food, but because they're looking for food on the way up, too.
Right. And, of course, I like to mention this for folks who may not know, but it's really easy to – I know all of your programming is free and available to the public, but you can also become a member of Juneau Audubon.
Yep, that's correct. And you can do it on our webpage or at the public meetings, whichever you like.
And it's like the cost of a coffee or something?
Yeah, it's only $10 a year to be a member of Juneau Audubon.
Wow, that's amazing. And all of the programming is free, even if you're not a member.
Correct.
Which I think is wonderful. And these talks are so educational and fun to listen to. It sounds like you're going to have a lot of video tomorrow, Bob, for your talk.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. That's really awesome. And so also, Brenda, what should we be looking for right now out in the wild, besides ravens, of course?
Well, our winter birds are definitely here. So you can see all the ducks and geese that spend the winter with us, and they like to spend the winter with us because our ocean doesn't freeze here. So every time the tide goes out and in, the smorgasbord is set again.
Right on. Okay. And is there a thing on your website about, like, is there a, like, tips and tricks page? Like, what's the best way to learn how to begin birding?
That's a great, great question. Yes, we do have some of that information, a little bit about eBird, too, that helps you identify birds quite easily, either by sound or pictures. And it'll help you find the web pages that are best for that, and walking trails and a bird list. So anywhere in Southeast, there's a great walking trail hikes and stuff for birds.
Awesome. That's great. Okay. Well, that's so cool. Naturebob.com, website for Bob, and all of the information and videos and pictures and books and all the different stuff is available there. And I'm sure your books are also like at Hearthside and things like that, I would imagine, as well.
A fair number.
Yeah.
They sell them, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And, of course, if you want to find out more about Juneau Audubon, you can go to JuneauAudubon.org. It's tomorrow night. It's Ravens in Juneau by Bob Armstrong. It's the monthly program. It's January 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the U.S. Egan Lecture Hall. And it's free and open to the public. And thanks for being here today. I really appreciate it. Nice to see you again, Brenda. Good to meet you, Bob.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Okay, up next, this week's Tongass Voices, Perspectives from the Homelands of the Occoquan and Beyond. Roblin Gray Davis is a professional actor, and he's bringing one of his favorite ways to hone his skills to Juneau in a 5-week-long clowning course. He says clowning can break down the walls we put up to see what's behind.
I am Roblin Gray Davis, and I am a theater maker, a lifelong Alaskan artist. Been in Juneau for over 25 years now, I do believe. And part of my interest in theater has been pursuing this idea of mask theater that comes out of the tradition of Jacques Lecoq, which was a school in Paris that kind of was fundamental in maybe reopening the theater world, the contemporary theater world, to ask, you know, how can we make this more lively and more topical and more interesting in general? And also, how can we train actors and performers, designers, directors to maybe create original work? Though I feel like I am still on my own personal journey in relationship to creating a red-nosed character, which, yes, sometimes the word clown is misinterpreted, perhaps, because of all of the scary movies and all of the different forms that clown theater has taken in the United States, from birthday clowns to circus clowns to the scary movie clowns. But this particular type of red nose clown theater work is coming out of actor training. So it's really part of this world of mask theater, where we're looking at putting on just what's the smallest mask we can put on our face, and that is just a little nose. There's something about how it changes the performer's face in just enough of a way that the audience can see a character and not necessarily the actor. Play and laughter and kind of a liberating creativity is the heart of this work, finding how we are unique as individuals and how our differences, our idiosyncrasies, are our strengths in a way as artists. That's what makes us interesting. If you can find that space as a creative artist where you are hitting a nerve in your audience that elicits genuine laughter, then you are doing something miraculous, I would say. I mean, acting is, I think, one of the most difficult art forms. I'm not a classical musician, so I'm sure, you know, that's probably a little more difficult. But as far as you as an artist needing to be the art form, right? We are, as actors, we are the art. So in order to tell those stories and to perform lively and with authenticity and being compelling as a performer on stage is difficult. It's a difficult task. And so so I think as actors, we need to continually work on ourselves to become more grounded, more present, more available to play, more in tune with our own creativity and those internal impulses we have, all that stuff that I think makes a good performer or a strong performer, someone who an audience goes, it didn't feel like they were acting at all. I felt that they were that character. In order to do that art form, you have to be limber, you have to be strong, you have to be resilient, you have to be present, you have to be all of these things. And this particular work of the clown, clowning around, gets at all of those really important principles of performing.
That was Juno actor Robin Gray Davis on his clowning workshop at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. We'll be right back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Hansen Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na khaya ha ane kak, gun chish.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. Listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. I'm joined now by Barb Miranda from the USDA Forest Service. Gunath Cheesh, Barb. Happy New Year.
Gunath Cheesh, Happy New Year to you, Boston. Yeah. Glad to be here.
Yeah, Wasit, how's it going?
It's going great. It's a new year for all of us here in Southeast Alaska. I wish we had a little bit more snow on the ground.
Yeah, this weird, it's always my favorite time when it rains and then it freezes and then it rains and then it freezes and then it melts and then it freezes. Those are fun mornings.
Yeah, can be. A little white stuff would be welcome, though.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah. So you all are still in the process of the Tongass Forest Plan revision, and I know you're going to let us know about the assessments going public this week, but let's remind everybody what the Tongass Forest Plan revision is, because the last few months we've had the USDA Forest Service on. We've been talking a lot about the Capitol Christmas tree, but right. Christmas is over and we're back to
Christmas
the plan.
Christmas is over, back to work, and yeah. And boy, what a labor of love it is. So the Tongass is embarking on it, revising its forest plan. Hasn't been done, completely revised for over 25 years, so it's time. And it's a comprehensive plan to provide the overall direction, vision, future for the Tongass. And we have been engaging with communities and people and tribes across Southeast for over a year now, and we are reaching our first big benchmark. But just a reminder, we're early in this process. We're not going to complete this till 2028. So there's plenty of opportunities for people to stay involved and stay engaged. And I'm really delighted to announce that we're have our assessments completed, which is the first step in the planning process.
So what does that mean, assessments?
Yeah, good question. So we're required to collect all the best available science, indigenous knowledge, local input to make an assessment for all sorts of different resources on the Tongass. There's things like terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems, carbon stocks, different sections that address all these, recreation and tourism. There's a section on the socioeconomic conditions of Southeast Alaska. There's a whole assessment section that I'm really excited about that describes the Tongass as an indigenous place. And all of these are describing the current conditions, trends, stresses, key takeaways that build the really solid foundation for us to then embark on this next phase of forest planning, which is a proposed action that is derived from what do we need to change from the old plan to manage the resources that we have today into the future. And the plan's going to be about, the duration of it is 15 years. So, we have to build a good plan so that we're feeling pretty good about how we're managing our backyard for the next couple decades.
And the public is involved in this in certain ways, right? They can offer feedback, and you do different periods of time where you're accepting that feedback.
So we're going to release the assessments to the public on Friday.
Okay.
And we're going to have a 45-day public comment period on those. We're going to be looking really for, did we miss something in any of these assessments? Are there reports or knowledge out there that we didn't include or didn't know about? Please let us know about that. We have a 45-day comment period for that, but we'll continue to accept information ongoingly. We're still not in the official NEPA process for the plan. That won't happen until next spring of 2026. But in April, we'll be going out to all the communities again, just like we did last April. We visited 25 communities across Southeast Alaska to really work with communities on what do we need to change and how we're currently managing the Tongass so that we can capture those interests in the next plan.
I see. Okay. And this is just reminding me how huge the Tongass is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, do you know off the top of your head? I know it's huge. Do you know off the top of your head how?
It's the biggest national forest in the nation, and it's like 16.8 million acres.
What?
It's vast.
Wow. That's amazing. And it covers so much of Southeast, right?
It covers so much of Southeast, and it's so, it's remarkably intact, right? So we're really lucky when I was asked this morning about some of the climate change impacts, which we have an assessment section for, that are happening that are really apparent in the lower 48 right now with the fires down in California. We are amazingly buffered from some of those really blatant climate change impacts, but we're really lucky to live in a place that's resilient, but climate change is also having an impact on the Tongass. So that's one of the things that we got to really incorporate into this next plan, because that wasn't on our radar screen 25 years ago with the plan we're working with now.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were just talking to Bob Armstrong in the previous interview about that, and that was basically over he's been working in this sort of 1960, I think, or so. So he's been around a while, and that was the thing he talked about was the decline of animals and the decline of things that he's seen. And his hope was that we figure out what to do about climate change and the effect. And I'm imagining, because the Tongass is so vast, that it affects various different communities in different ways. Do you find that in the information you're getting from the public or from the when you go out to meet with communities?
I mean, not necessarily related to climate change now, but I mean, if you've been to one community in Southeast Alaska, you've been to one community in Southeast Alaska, right? Like they're all so unique. And I feel so fortunate that I managed to live in Gustavus, Alaska when I first moved here, almost 18 years ago now.
Congratulations.
Still youngin' from Alaska standards. But, every community is different and has different needs and desires and places where we go subsistence harvest. And so we really feel like we need to build a plan that takes those things into account as well.
Yeah. And is this the assessments you said are going to be released on Friday? Where's the best place for the public to engage? Is that the website?
Yes. Go to the website to find them. And, there's a big long URL that I'm hoping you'll post on your website. But if your listeners can just do a search for Tongass Forest Plan Revision, you'll find our Forest Plan Revision page, which will have all the community engagements, the assessment release will be on there, the individual assessment sections. You'll go to the ones that interest you. You don't have to read all 21 of them because that's how many sections there are. But there's, you know, there's something in there for everybody. And, you know, like if you're in the recreation, if you recreate on the Tongass, there, you know, read the recreation section. If tourism's your jam or you're that conflict that we're dealing with sometimes with between industrial tourism and recreation, there's a you know, assessment section for you to read. The geology and geologic hazards assesses some of the things that we're seeing happening here locally and in other places with landslides and such. So it's really quite comprehensive collection of information. And we just really want folks to take a look and let us know if there's things that we missed or need to add or amend. This is the time to do that.
And they'll be out on Friday, and you have 45 days to give your public comments on those assessments. And yeah, the link is long because it's a government website. So why wouldn't it be? A lot of slashes in there. I'll definitely post that. But it is easy to just Google Tongass Forest Plan Revision or search in your web browser of choice, your search engine of choice. But there's another website, the sustainablesoutheast.net, that you shared with me. What is that website
about? Well, so last April, we went and visited 25 communities, like I said, and we took all that information and assembled it and have it available. It's called Voices for the Future for the Tongass. It's a beautiful publication, and it lists out the things we heard as we traveled across Southeast. And there's really a really nice section there that's laid out by community of what those communities said were their biggest priorities for the Tongass. I just encourage people to go to that
URL.
URL. Hopefully you'll post it.
I will.
But it's really a beautiful article that sums up what we heard and what all our partners and tribes are doing already to manifest the vision, the collective vision we have for the Tongass going forward.
I love it. That's so cool. Yeah, that's at sustainablesoutheast.net. There's a long slash after that. I'll make sure I post that. It's U.S. Forest Service Tongass Collaboration, A Promise to the Future, is the part after the slash of that on sustainablesoutheast.net. But we'll post both of those links on the webpage for today's episode. Or you can just Google it and it'll be there, which is kind of cool. So that's the Tongass Forest Plan Revision. It's continuing for a number of years. It's in its early stages. Even though it's been a year or so, it's still what we call the early stages.
Yep.
And we look forward to hearing more about that. I want to turn to another cool thing that's happening from the USDA Forest Service, and that's the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center's Fireside Chat Series, which is beginning this Friday. Tell us a little bit about Fireside Chats.
Yeah, so for those of you that haven't been to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center in the winter on a Friday evening, don't miss out. The lights leading up to the Visitor Center are lit, and it's just a magical way to spend an evening with your close friends or family. And we've been doing Fireside Chats, which are sort of similar to the Egan Lecture Series, where we have local subject matter experts or international subject matter experts coming in and talk about really interesting things. And so we've been doing these for over, you know, since the Visitor Center opened in 1964.
Whoa.
Yeah, so it's a longstanding Juneau tradition. So if you're new to Juneau, go check it out. It's really a fun way to spend a Friday evening. And gosh, sometimes you can hear the ice cracking on the lake and the glacier calving, and Nugget Falls is booming. Walking out to the glacier in the evening is pretty magical too.
Wow, that's kind of cool. And that is happening is this the first one this Friday?
Yeah, the first one's this Friday, and it's a special program. It's called So You're a Junior Ranger, Now What? And it's really family oriented. Mm-hmm. We've got a bunch of our Forest Service folks in there ready to talk to people of all ages about what they do. And it's really, it is focused on families, and it's from 7 to 8 p.m. Every Friday. So the first one is So You're a Junior Ranger, Now What? It teaches children what the Forest Service does in its backyard, the Tongass National Forest. And we encourage this. This is a really family fun event. So from 7 to 8 tomorrow night, go to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor
Friday
Center.
Friday night. Yeah, Friday, January 10th is So You're a Junior Ranger, Now What? I love the title of that one. That's so good. And do they continue every Friday after that?
Every Friday after that. And there's topics ranging from archaeology and clues from the past with our Indiana Jones of the Forest Service, Laura Klingman, to how to identify fluke patterns and blubber bits to help track the health of whales, the bears and the Kootsnawu. So we've got wide-ranging topics, and our co-stewardship agreement with Tlingit and Haida means that they're going to be doing a talk on the story of stewardship of past, present, and future there. And that one's on February 23rd. We're really excited about that, really excited about the co-stewardship agreement we have with Tlingit and Haida out there and the cultural ambassadors that have been working out there side by side with us as well. So
I love that.
So we're excited about this. It's a longstanding tradition. I think we went virtual during the pandemic, but we've been doing these every year since the Visitor Center opened.
And can people find information at the Visitor Center website on these talks or
the
schedule?
Yeah, once again, let the search be your power, but just Google Mendenhall Fireside Chats, and you'll get the whole 2024-25 program.
And do you all have a Facebook page?
Yes. So the Tongass National Forest has a Facebook page, and the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center has a Facebook page. So those are other ways to find out what's currently going on on the Tongass and at the Visitor Center.
I love that. Barb Miranda from the USDA Forest Service, thank you so much. The assessments for the Tongass Forest Plan Revision will be out and available this Friday. You can search Tongass Forest Plan Revision, and you will find that information at the fs.usda.gov website. And, of course, the Fireside Chat series begins this Friday with So You're a Junior Ranger, Now What? It starts at 7 o'clock out at the Mendenhall Visitor Center, and this one is very family-friendly. So get out there and enjoy a nice, warm, it's probably some beautiful, hopefully it'll be nice weather and you can see out the windows there at the Visitor Center and be really cozy while you listen to these experts talk about what goes on at the USDA Forest Service. So thank you so much, Barb. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Do it for today's Juno Afternoon. A special program tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, an hour-long conversation with the organizers and artists from the upcoming Point House Benefit Concerts, Hit Wushte Yadu Kicht, Dancing Our House Together, Jericho Blang, Lakota Harden, John Gourley from Portugal the Man, Yaith Yatsin, Nicholas Glannon from Yatsin, and singer-songwriter Samantha Crane. That's on tomorrow's show at 3 p.m. right here on Juno Afternoon, which airs Wednesday through Friday here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, and have a joyous Juno evening.